land use planning. And so I've asked Ann Castle here to talk to you a little bit. She's done some work in that area. Ann is a very good friend of mine, even though she's at CU right now. She is a fellow there at the Getchess Wilkinson Center. She is a former assistant secretary for water and science, where she oversaw water and science policy for the Obama administration. She's also a water attorney, a recovering one maybe at that. And she worked in the state of Colorado for many, many years and is well known in the Colorado arena. So with that, Ann, I'm going to kick it over to you. Thank you for joining us, Ann.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. And hello, everybody, and special hello to Durango and all the people joining from there. As Jennifer said, she and I go back a long way. And Jennifer, of course, was my successor at the Interior Department and as Assistant Secretary for Water and Science. So we know a lot of the same stuff and a lot of the same people. But she asked me today to talk about the integration of water and land use planning, which is something that is hard. It's hard to talk about. Not many people know what it means exactly. So I'm going to try to provide some basics and some ideas about how we can do this within the state of Colorado, what tools are available to us, and what kind of a difference we can make if we do this right. And if I'm talking over somebody's head or you don't understand what I just said, just stop me and we can make it better. So, first question is, why are we talking about this? And you all know very well, because this is your whole course about sustainability, that we have a water gap that we either have now or anticipate having more demand than there is supply. We're looking at reduced supplies because of climate change, and we're seeing that so dramatically in the last 2 years, especially in the Colorado River Basin. We're looking at increased demand, whether it's because of population growth or because of climate change requiring more water to grow the stuff that we're already growing. There's uncertainty that we have to deal with in terms of reliability of supply. What are the supplies going to look like in the future? And climate change is the elephant in the room. So that all has created a gap between supply and demand that puts a real premium on water conservation, because we can't just go out and develop new supplies. We've got to use the supplies that we have more efficiently. So traditionally in Colorado and in a lot of places, water conservation has been focused on the water supplier. So the city of Fort Collins or the water district that provides drinking water to your home. And they have some tools available that are in widespread use in Colorado. The rate structure, how they charge for the water that you take into your house. So there may be what they call a increasing or graduated block rate structure, where as you get higher up in the tiers of water use, it costs more per unit per 1,000 gallons. So it's designed to disincentivize overuse and to try to send a price signal to the biggest consumers of water. Tap fees, that's another tool that water suppliers have to try to incentivize conservation. So, I mean, just at the real basic level, if you have a 3/4 inch tap coming into your house, that's going to cost more than a 1-inch tap because the 1-inch tap is going to use less water. And there's other way more creative things that can be done with tap fees. Some water suppliers, a lot in Colorado, will have irrigation restrictions that kick in when they say they're going to kick in. So maybe if the reservoirs get low or if it's a really dry year and their supplies are dwindling, you can only water 3 days a week or 2 days a week, and you can't water between 8 and 6 p.m. So things that are designed to use irrigation water more efficiently and use less of it. But the problem is that those tools are limited, and the water supplier, whoever it is, has to serve whatever kind of development the land use authority has approved. So if the land use authority approves a new subdivision of 1-acre lots and anybody can have whatever sort of lawn they want, then the water supplier has to serve that. And that can become a big problem when I think I skipped one here. Hang on. Here we go. The initial configuration of the development, what the land use plan looks like on paper. Is it 1-acre lots that are really spread out? Or is it a more dense configuration? That has a huge influence on what the future water demand is going to be. So the water supplier can mess around with the rate structure and tap fees, but if this picture on the right is what has been approved, that's the biggest determinant of what the overall water use is going to be. So what that tells us is that if the land use regulation, the zoning regulations, the master plan for the area, if they're created initially with water conservation in mind, thinking through what the available supplies are, and how we want the neighborhood to look, but how much water we want it to use, that has huge potential to reduce the water footprint of any development, and not only this year, but forever. So that's why we need to think at the beginning about how land use decisions, zoning, master plans, subdivision approvals, how all of that has an impact on water use in the future. So obviously a benefit of getting in on the ground floor and thinking about the land use configuration from the beginning and what that's going to mean for water use, that can mean reduced water use overall. And that can allow the city or the water district to serve anticipated growth with the same amount of water. And that's a huge issue for almost all water suppliers in the state of Colorado. They're anticipating growth. Colorado is in the top 10 of the fastest growing states in the U.S. and has been for years. And so the ability to absorb growth and to serve growth with water is a big concern of water suppliers. If we use less water per capita or per household, then they've got more water that they can use to serve that anticipated growth. It also can provide resilience so that if we're seeing the kind of reduced supplies that we have been seeing over the past several years, they can absorb that because they've got the buffer that's provided by conservation. So that's a direct benefit. But we also hear from a lot of communities that they have other community goals that can be met or at least enhanced by conservation. So for example, there are many mountain communities in Colorado that want to preserve the stream flows, the streams that flow through the community or are, you know, part of the nearby city park, or just the rivers and streams where people in the community go to recreate. They don't want those streams to dry up. So if you're using less water in the community, that can mean more water for the stream flows that they can enjoy for recreation or aesthetic purposes. Other communities would like to ensure that their surrounding agricultural land is preserved. They want to preserve that agricultural heritage, and they worry that if growth continues and we're using the same amount of water per household or per capita, then the water supplier has to look to that ag land that's close by to buy up the water rights, dry up the land, and use that additional water in their portfolio. If you're trying to preserve that ag land, conservation can help achieve that goal as well. So the point being here that there are indirect benefits that may serve community goals as well. But it's hard. And that's why it's been hard over time. We don't have a lot of experience with integrating land use planning and water supplies. One of the biggest problems is that the water supplier and the land use authority can be totally separate governmental entities. So, for example, you may reside in a county, unincorporated part of a county. Your water supply comes from a special district, a water district or a water and sanitation district. The county commissioners are exercising the land use authority. So they're determining what gets built, what sort of new development is approved. But the water district has to serve it. And the water district frequently has zero input into what the county commissioners are deciding. There are all sorts of overlapping jurisdictions. I think Fort Collins is a good example where the city of Fort Collins serves a portion of this area within the city boundaries. There are a couple of water districts that serve some other portions of the city of Fort Collins, and the city water utilities serve some areas outside of the city limits. And so you've got all this overlapping governmental authority, and it's hard to keep track of. Denver Water probably has the biggest problem because it's serving 27 different land use authorities. So that's real hard for the water supplier, Denver, to coordinate with those 27 different entities and have input into what the water footprint will be of the new development that they're approving. So that's one of the reasons it's hard. But I will tell you that even when the water utility and the land use planning authority are in the same governmental umbrella, like take Aurora. So City of Aurora has a water utility, Aurora Water. They are in the same building and they're under the same city council, but it's still hard because they've always been separate departments that didn't necessarily talk to each other because they had separate missions. And that's the dilemma that we have to deal with here. So this next slide is just an illustration of how it's hard. We have these traditional silos where people are working in their lane and doing the stuff that they're supposed to be doing. And coordinating with this totally separate governmental entity is time out of your day. And it's it hasn't traditionally been part of the job. And the public and developers even are not necessarily aware of these issues. They just want to make sure they have a water supply. That's it. They're done. So that's part of what makes this a hard problem. But we have some tools in Colorado. There are some statutory tools. And one of them is the requirement that water providers put together water efficiency plans. These used to be called water conservation plans, and then for some reason the name got changed a few years ago. But water providers have to file these plans every 7 years, and they've had to do that for quite a while. But a more recent amendment to this statute required that those plans have to include an evaluation of best practices for implementing water conservation through land use planning. And that mouthful is coming right out of the statute. So evaluation of best practices for implementing conservation through land use planning. And the folks that have to file these water efficiency plans are what they call covered entities. And that's any water provider that serves out more than 2,000 acre feet per year, or any water provider entity that gets funding from the Colorado Water Conservation Board. And that last category is actually becoming the biggest of the various different entities that have to file these plans. So the problem is, and I'll talk about this more later, that water providers didn't necessarily know what the best practices were for implementing water conservation through land use planning. And so that's kind of the evolution of learning that we're going through now. Also, I'm sure you all have looked at the Colorado Water Plan, and one of its measurable objectives is that by 2025, which is like really soon, 75% of Coloradans will live in communities that have incorporated water saving actions into land use planning. Not entirely clear what that means. I think the intent was that the land use planning entity for 75% of Coloradans will have done something about water conservation. And one of the things that is happening with the update to the Colorado Water Plan is there the folks at the Water Conservation Board who work on land use stuff are trying to figure out what the metrics are for determining whether that objective has been met. And then we have another Colorado statute that deals with water adequacy. And this may be the strongest tool available to integrate land use planning with water. So this is part of the local government statutes. And there's a provision that says a local government cannot approve a development permit until the applicant demonstrates that the water supply is adequate. I mean, that sounds just common sense, but it has some teeth here. A local government can include either a county or a city, and a development permit can mean the subdivision approval, the building permit, go ahead. It could be master plan approval. The local government gets to decide at what point in the development process they will impose this requirement, but it has to be at some point. They have to make a determination that the water supply is adequate. Now, this applies by statute to development of 50 or more units. So it's not applicable, at least as far as the statute goes, to small developments.
So, Anne, I have a question here. This is my question. Oh, have they defined adequate? It looks like that's your next slide.
It is. Yes. At least they've told us what adequate needs to include, what you need to think about. So adequate means quality, quantity, dependability, and availability. Interesting that quality is part of that. So it's not just a quantity equation. And then this is all part of the same statute, but it says that this adequacy determination may include conservation measures. Doesn't have to, but it may. And there have been some litigated cases about this statute and what it means. And it's clear from the decisions in those cases that local governments have a ton of discretion in determining what adequate means. So there's a spectrum. And some local governments are real strict about it and have transparent, objective rules. Others, it's sort of, you know, like rub your tummy and how does it feel? There was an attempt about 4 years ago to amend this statute and specifically this second provision here to require that conservation measures be part of the water plan that's being put forth by the developer in order to get an adequacy determination. And that proposed amendment didn't go forward, but it's something that people think about. So a local government could require that water conservation measures be part of a development proposal. They totally have the discretion to do that. They're not required to by the statute, but they could. They could also decrease that minimum number of units that they're looking at to make a water adequacy determination. So they could make it 2 units. Anything that required any sort of a permit from the planning department or the county commissioners or city council, whatever, they could require that there be a water plan and that they make an adequacy determination. And some governments have decreased that unit threshold. So there are a number of tools available that can help people figure out how to do this better, how to integrate land use planning into water supply planning. Western Resource Advocates has really been a leader in this area, and they have published this guidebook on integrating water efficiency into land use planning, and it is very comprehensive. And it has different chapters on the various different stages that land planners look at development permits in. So comprehensive plans, which is the big plan for the whole county or the city limits. Zoning regs, so that's determining where different types of development go and what you can do on a plot of land in a certain area. And then subdivision regulations, which is what governs specific development plans. So it's a really good start. And I think you guys have taken a look at that. Then there is...
And let me interrupt just a second here. Yes, those for the students, that there's a link to that report in your Canvas file. And for others, we have it also on our website. That in this next guide, I think that Anne's going to talk about. So you're ready to get to it.
Good. That's great. The next one is also from Western Resource Advocates. It's just about tap fees and how tap fees can be used creatively to incentivize water conservation. And by the way, both of these reports or books have examples from Colorado. They're good resources. They're very comprehensive. And so, you know, it would take a while to wade through them. But if you're a land planner and that's your job, then it's a terrific resource. There's another group that was pulled together, oh gosh, probably 5 or 6 years ago by the governor to try to talk about these issues, called the Colorado Water and Growth Dialogue. And the idea was bring the planners together, bring the water suppliers in, have them talk to each other and figure out what they need. And this report from 2018 was the result of that effort. And it's very useful in that it gives you guidance about, okay, what would happen to the water demand if we had quarter acre lots as opposed to half acre lots, or if we limited landscaping to 3,000 square feet of whatever lot size you have. It has spreadsheet tools that you can plug that stuff in and see what the difference is in terms of water use. So it's a really good mechanism for doing a cost-benefit analysis on, okay, if we impose this type of requirement, we being city council or planning department or county commissioners, what difference will it make? Is it worth it to us? And it's also useful for those planners to talk with developers about and demonstrate that if we do this kind of requirement for landscaping, here's the difference it'll make, and that'll make us more able to serve future development or you know, whatever they're concerned with. So it's a really good a tool that is available for people to use. Then the Babbitt Center for Land and Water Policy has done a specific guidance on incorporating water into comprehensive planning. And comprehensive plans are required for local governments, and there's certain requirements within those comprehensive plans that they have to address. And these are big documents. They address roads and utilities and water, although they're not required to address water. So this is guidance that was written by my colleague, Aaron Rudland at the Babbitt Center for Land and Water Policy about how you can put water into a comp plan. They're also called master plans. They're sort of interchangeable terms. And this is aimed at the whole Colorado River Basin, not just the state of Colorado. So the idea is, how do you translate policy into the comprehensive plan process? And then I know you've taken a look at this as well. Again, Aaron Rugland from the Babbitt Center and I wrote this guidance manual on best practices for implementing water conservation through land use planning. All the previous reports and books, guidance documents that I've put up on the screen, they're all aimed at land use planners. And it's sort of an education of planning folks about how water works and how their decisions ripple through into ultimate water use. There haven't been many tools available or guidance available that was aimed at water suppliers. And if you think back to that first statute that I put up, it requires the water supplier's water efficiency plan to evaluate best practices for implementing water conservation through land use planning. So this guidance document was intended to help them figure out what the best practices are, and to figure out what would work best for them. So I'm going to go into this in a little more detail. This guidance document has more than 100 land use practices from all over the West, you know, things that different water suppliers have tried in integrating land use planning into their water supply activities. And the reason there's so many is because this is a huge spectrum of organizations that have to think about this stuff. So water districts that may be so small, they're only providing water to 100 households. And then, you know, going the other end of the spectrum, Denver Water that serves 1.5 million people. So you're not going to find best practices in common for that huge spectrum of entities. There's no one size fits all. So we wanted to provide a spectrum of best practices that people could take a look at and figure out what would work best for them. And it's an electronic document. It's all with hyperlinks to the source documents for the different communities that we're talking about, the ordinances that have been used, so that people can jump directly to what they need to see. So it is divided into four different sections, different types of activities that will help integrate water supply and land use planning. First is foundational, meaning you got to do this much at least. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Second is technical assistance and incentives. So these are hopefully persuasive, incentives to conserve more water, not mandates. That's the third category, ordinances and regulations. So those are something that could be adopted by the land use authority that imposes a requirement. And then a lot of education and outreach to educate the public about why this matters and what they can do to conserve water. So a couple of examples from the foundational activities. First, you have to have a team. You've got to have a team that has people from both the water supplier and the land use planning department. They have to use the same data. And we could go down that rabbit hole for a while, but they need to use the same data. And then water needs to be something that's thought about in the development approval process. Incentives, this is just some of the different kinds of things that that land use planners could adopt. You could get a bonus for density. And what that means is if you have a plot of land that you could normally build 10 units on, if you make those more dense so that they will use less water because there's less area for irrigation, then you can build 12 units. So you get a bonus of some units, and that's attractive to developers. Infill incentives so that you're not encouraging people to go out to the next area beyond what's developed already, but they have incentive to fill in. And that helps the water supplier because you don't have to lay new pipe. Tap fee reductions, guarantees for future building permits that the fees won't increase, and reduced water dedication requirements, which are, that's a big deal for developers. If they can conserve and convince the land use authority that they're not going to use as much water and therefore they don't need to dedicate as much water, that saves them a lot of money. So here's some things that you could give incentives for. Water sense outdoor fixtures, gray water systems, so you're recycling the shower and the sink water and using that for irrigation, low water use landscaping, high efficiency irrigation, rain sensors, all the kind of tech stuff that can help conserve. And then just some other examples from the guidebook, water efficient landscape codes. We have some really good examples of how that works and local governments that have adopted them. Stormwater management practices and coordinating regionally is something that needs to happen more and can save water.
And let me just stop you for right now. Dick Tinsley had a question. You might have answered it, but does all the water adequacy and water use represent single use of water, or does it take into account gray water return flows?
It can certainly take into account gray water return flows, because if you're able, if the city or the water district is able to recycle water, then that will, by definition, reduce the water use per household. So the new water use per household. So that is obviously a big area for exploration and one that is becoming more common. We've got some water law issues there though, right? Because under Colorado's system of water law, Without special circumstances, you can only get one use of the water. And so that all has to be taken into account. But yeah, gray water can definitely be part of the solution. And this is just an example page from the guidebook, just to show you, you know, we've got examples from Westminster, Colorado Springs, Eagle County, with hyperlinks to the source. So Jennifer, if I have time, I'll just go through a couple of case studies real quick.
Go ahead, Anne, we've got time.
Okay. So Westminster is really a leading example of good coordination between the land use planning department and the water provider. Now, they're in the same governmental umbrella. They're both city of Westminster, but the simplest way for me to explain it is they have a map, a plan of the whole city, and they know what the zoning is in every sector of the city. And each of those sectors has a water volume component associated with it. So they know what their water supply is. The water utility within the city of Westminster knows what their limits are, and they've assigned that water volume to different places in the city. So if a developer comes in and says, I want to build 100 units on this piece of property, they are able to say, yes, we've planned for that. We have enough water. Or no, there's not enough water for you to do that. So you're going to have to figure out something different, either fewer units or you've got to use less water per unit. And so that's really a seamless integration of water and land use planning. And then they have this water efficiency goal to reduce their gallons per capita per day. Aurora has done some creative stuff with their tap fees. So they have tap fee reductions for low water use landscaping or zero water use landscaping. And one of the things you can do is you can say, I'm not going to use water on this area. I'm going to have a water tap to start out because I need to get the zero water use vegetation established. But after 3 years, after I've watered it for a while and it's rooted and established, then the city's going to come out and take the water tap away. And that can save a lot of money if that's something a developer is willing to do. And they have been striving over the years to ensure that the Aurora Water Utility is involved in the permitting process, the development approval process. And that works pretty well. Again, they're in the same governmental entity, so it's a lot easier for them to do. Santa Fe, they require all developers to get a certificate of compliance that all the plumbing fixtures meet water conservation requirements. So that's just, you know, part of the deal if you're getting a development permit in Santa Fe. And then finally, Las Vegas has really done a lot in this area. They don't allow turf in front yards, period. New house, no turf in the front yard. 50% of the side and rear yards can be grass, but no more. You can't have turf in multifamily common areas. And recently they've adopted an ordinance that says you can't have any non-functional turf. And they say non-functional turf is grass that's only walked on when it's mowed. So things like highway medians or the strip between the sidewalk and the street, no turf there. And that saves a ton of water. So those are some of the kinds of things that you can do. So Jennifer, let me stop there and I'd love to hear what your students are thinking.
That's great, Anne. And I'm going to ask you to take off your presentation. Questions from students or guests?
I have a quick question. So for Las Vegas, is that only for new development or is the non-functional turf, are they removing existing non-functional turf?
It is for new development, but you've probably heard too that Las Vegas has a cash for grass program where they will buy out your grass. It was $1 per square foot. If you take out turf and replace it with xeriscape vegetation or rocks, I think it's now $2 per square foot. It depends on how much money they have available. But, you know, when they first instituted that program, they had more applicants than they had money. And so that, again, has been their way of dealing with sort of retrofitting the existing community to be more water conserving.
Any other questions?
I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
I was wondering from your presentation if there's any coordination coming up with land use agencies and possibly water use and reclamation. Seems like there's a strong focus right now on just reducing water uses overall. So is there any efforts to coordinate any new water reuse for land development?
Like recycled water? Reused water? Yeah, absolutely. I haven't seen, at least not in Colorado, any requirements that a portion of the water supply be recycled water. You know, we have some pretty strict water quality regulations about how you use recycled water. And at present, you cannot use recycled water for direct potable reuse, only for indirect and irrigation. So there's coordination that also needs to occur with the water quality regulators, and they're working on that now. They've got a big effort ginned up to try to come up with sensible regulations for direct potable reuse. But I haven't seen any requirements, but it's becoming a market-based phenomenon because it is so expensive to develop brand new water supplies that recycled water, like water conservation of any kind, is a much cheaper form of stretching your existing supplies and being able to serve new development.
Good question, Brennan. Anyone else?
I had a quick question about your example of Aurora Water having the temporary tap and then removing it once the xeriscape vegetation has been established.
Yeah.
Isn't your tap your access to the main for just your entire home? Like, isn't that where your water from your faucet comes from as well? Isn't there just one tap for the home?
Well, normally, yes. But in this case, no. They put in a separate irrigation tap that can be turned off, or I don't know if they just turn it off or actually physically remove the connection, but that's how they make this work. So there's sort of a built-in enforcement mechanism.
And just okay. To let you all know, Troy Bowder just put in the chat link to CDPH's ease. Water quality reclaimed water reuse permits for that information. And I apologize, CJ, I interrupted.
Well, that's okay. So does that mean that once that tap has been shut down, that is that your exterior water for your home? You know, would that also mean that you couldn't, you know, wash the outside of your home with a hose or something like that? You know, I was curious, like what do you lose once that tap is gone if it's just been dedicated to irrigation and potentially other outdoor uses?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I think there is somewhat of an honor system going on here, but there are water police that are going to come around 3 years after your development permit was issued and see if you're irrigating anything. And so they do have some enforcement follow-up, but it wasn't intended to prevent people from washing the cars in the driveway or, you know, hosing down the deck or whatever. It's intended to take away the consistent day after day, year after year use of water for irrigation.
Thank you.
Sure.
So we just have a few minutes left, and Anne has worked on another project I think many of you would be interested in, and I've asked her to speak to it. And this is talking about access to clean water by tribes using the Colorado River. And so, Anne, would you mind just giving us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for asking, Jennifer. This is an effort that grew out of a group called the Colorado River Water and Tribes Initiative, which is a group that's been around for about 4 years. And it was initiated to elevate tribal voices in connection with decision-making and discussions around management and operation of the Colorado River. And, you know, a valid concern that when the Colorado River operating guidelines were put into place in 2007, the tribes were not at the table. And so this group was set up to provide a focal point for tribal voices to be part of those discussions. But in the last year and a half, because of the pandemic, there's been a lot of focus on the disproportionate incidence of COVID on reservations. And it's huge and continuing. The hospitalization and death rate from COVID among Native Americans is the highest of any ethnic group. And there's been some work done over the past year and a half that correlates the incidence of COVID, the higher incidence of COVID on reservations, to lack of access to clean water. And so if you look into the status of access to water within Native American communities, the disparity is staggering. Native American households are 19 times more likely than white ones to lack indoor plumbing, 19 times. And as many as almost half of Native American homes don't have complete indoor plumbing, meaning you might have water, but there's an outhouse, or they might have not either water or sanitation. And all of that works together, right? You know, public health, access to water. And clearly there are racial justice, environmental justice issues here. So we have a small group that has tried to elevate the knowledge, the education about this problem, this lack of access to clean drinking water among our neighbors, and how widespread it is. And it's in this country where we think of ourselves as having the, you know, these terrific utilities and social services available to us, basic services. So we've done a lot of work to get some real hard data on what access to clean drinking water looks like among the 30 tribes in the Colorado River Basin. But we've also looked more broadly nationwide at the federal trust responsibility to Indian tribes to provide a permanent livable homeland and how that intersects with having a clean drinking water supply. And we've looked at the various different federal agency programs that are aimed at solving a portion of this problem and how they either work together or don't, and what kind of resources are needed to solve the problem. And the good news is that the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the one that passed the Senate, that might pass the House, who knows, has $3.5 billion in it for the Indian Health Service, and the portion of the Indian Health Service that deals with the construction of water and sanitation systems. That is that's the number that the Indian Health Service has identified as the unmet need for sanitation facilities. And then they say sanitation facilities, they mean water and sanitation. So fingers crossed that that passes. The bipartisan bill also has big plus ups for EPA in their state revolving funds, and a percentage of those funds go to what they call tribal set-asides. And that money is granted to tribes to deal with clean water or safe drinking water. So we're hopeful. It's not the whole banana. There's more that needs to be done, and we're currently trying to get some of that more included in the budget reconciliation package. Don't know if that will happen. Don't know if it'll pass. But and we're working on a report right now that recommends a whole of government approach to solving this problem. Because like I said, there's a bunch of different federal agencies that own a piece of it. And they all have different funding streams and different authorities and different application processes. And having a sort of one-stop shop would help solve the problem. So we think this is a moment in time where the Biden administration is focused on COVID recovery and economic recovery and infrastructure and racial justice and climate change, and all of those things come together in the need to get clean drinking water to tribal communities. And there's infrastructure funding, and people are, I think, more aware of the historical treatment of tribal communities and how we need to make that better.
That was a great summary. And I just wanted to give you past some personal experience I had when I worked for the federal government during the Bush administration. I went out on the Navajo in the Navajo Nation, and I met several people. The one who stuck in my mind was this 90-year-old grandmother who drove 60 miles to get her water in the barrels that were in the back of her truck. And she made that trip twice a week. Mm-hmm. And it just really brought home the need that Ann is talking about. So with that, any last questions for Ann, either on land use planning or tribal water issues? Thank you so much for your attention, Ann. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. And hope all of you have a nice evening.
We'll see you next week. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Jennifer.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So next week.
I have a quick question for you, Jennifer.
Sure, CJ.
I think that Anne had mentioned a tool that you didn't have a link to.
It's the one